You are tuned in to Studio22Live.tv, podcast episode number 29 with international best-selling author and life transformational coach, Bruce Van Horn. Welcome to Studio22Live.tv podcast, where we discuss valuable topics, interview amazing people sharing their stories and valuable lessons learned to educate, empower, and impact lives across the world. Welcome back to Studio22Live.tv podcast. I'm your host, Fred Fitzgiles, and this is episode 29, and we are so glad you are back with us. Today, we're talking on the topic of health, not only physical health, but also health and your happiness. How happy are you? Are you really happy? Are you not? Are you full of joy? Are you full of fear, doubt, and worry? Well, after today's episode, I can guarantee you, you will worry no more. We have a very, very special guest. This gentleman is a person that knows how to deal with challenges and adversity and come through with flying colors. Our special guest today is Mr. Bruce Van Horn. He is the dad, a best-selling author, speaker, thought leader, transformational life coach, and cancer conqueror. He also is the host of his own podcast called Life is a Marathon. I was listening to his show. I was very inspired. And I was admiring, I mean, this gentleman has plenty of followers on Twitter. But once I spoke to him, I recognized that he's a true great man. And his story, I'm telling you, I cannot wait for you to hear his story. It is going to absolutely turn your life around. So without any further delay, we're going to move forward to the next segment of the show so we can introduce you to Mr. Bruce Van Horn, coming up next on the Studio22Live.tv podcast. But before we get started, I always love to start this off on a high positive note. So yes, next up is our joke of the week. This one's called Not Paying Attention. A man walked into the office in a school. "Excuse me," he said to the secretary, "I would like to come to school. I never got a chance to finish school when I was younger, and I want to finally learn how to read and write." Okay, said the secretary. "Just fill out this form." And that's our joke of the week. Next up is our birthday shout outs. I want to give a special happy birthday to Tina V. Gladney, Lou Crosscove, DJ Doc B, Dorothea Coleman, Kelly Gokuria Yarnell, my man Rob Hill up in Pennsylvania, my man Mark Bannon, author of 100 Years Breaking the Cycle, who was on episode number 7, Diane Norwood, Tracy Thompson, and last but not least, Kisona Keesney Clark. Happy birthday from Studio22Live.tv. Our guest today is a gentleman that I recently met on Twitter. And I have been following him just because he's just been a light pretty much going across the entire web. And I reached out to him recently, and I'm just honored and blessed for him to be able to come on the show with us. He has an amazing story. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to share with you his bio so we can introduce to you Mr. Bruce Van Horn to our listeners. Bruce Van Horn is a dad, best-selling author, speaker, thought leader, transformational life coach, business owner, marathon runner, and cancer conqueror. He is also the host of Life is a Marathon, a popular internet radio show podcast with listeners in over 187 countries around the world. Bruce loves sharing his life's experiences and respected insight to help people to overcome their negative thinking and limiting beliefs and develop a winning mindset. Bruce loves people and loves coaching them to become the fullest expression of who they were created to be. lives in Richmond, Virginia, and we're extremely honored to have Mr. Bruce Van Horn. Welcome to the Steel22Live.tv podcast.
Thank you, Fred. I really appreciate that. Hope you're having a beautiful morning.
I'm definitely having a beautiful morning, but it's a little bit cold. Is it cold down there where you're at, sir?
Yes, sir. It was 31 degrees this morning.
And I don't know if you're like me.
I had to scrape frost off of the window. It's the first time this year to do that.
And I can't believe it because I refuse to turn the heat on, but it looks like it's going to win.
I think so. I turned mine on last night.
Did you? Okay, awesome. Well, I just want to thank you again for being on the show. What I want to do is I want you to kind of introduce yourself to our listeners and just tell us a little bit about your background. Did you grow up in Virginia, born and raised?
For the most part, I've lived in Richmond, Virginia since I was 7 years old, and I'm 52, so you can do the math.
Oh, yeah.
I've pretty been here all my life, you know, but originally born in Dayton, Ohio, but didn't spend a lot of time there.
Gotcha, so, okay. All right. You have any brothers and sisters?
I have two brothers, an older brother and a younger brother, and neither of them live in Virginia. They moved on. One is in North Carolina. And the other one, he kind of moves around a lot right now, and right now he's in Florida.
How was it being a younger brother? Did he pick on you a lot?
Well, I was the middle of two, so you know, or the middle of three. So actually, I didn't get picked on a lot, but what I wound up doing was through the years mediating to keep my older brother and my younger brother from killing each other because my older brother was, when he was in his teen years, was pretty mean to my youngest brother. Mm-hmm. And then when my youngest brother got old enough to retaliate, he did. So I wound up being the referee. I wound up being the peacekeeper in my family.
What high school did you graduate from?
I graduated from Benedictine Military Academy in Richmond, Virginia.
Okay. And how was that experience? I'm taking you back a little bit.
Yeah, no, it's great. Yeah, it's an all-male Catholic military high school, and it still exists. It's been around for, 150 years. It's a very, very old traditional school in Richmond, Virginia, and I loved it. You know, so I didn't have to deal with, I guess, a lot of the types of pressures that, you know, I've got an 18-year-old now who's a senior in high school, and, you know, there's just so... You know, first of all, the world is quite different than it is now then,
sure.
But, you know, there was an all-girls school down the street, mm-hmm. you know, but we didn't interact with each other on a day-to-day basis, mm-hmm. You know, so there were benefits and potentially drawbacks, but I don't really know what the drawbacks were because I didn't experience it, but I enjoyed the process.
It doesn't matter what school we go to, we always have that. I want to be. I want to grow up to be. What was that for you?
Oh, yeah. You know, really from the time I was about 14 or 15 years old. So really through most of my high school years and all through college, because it's what I studied to do, I wanted to be a writer.
Okay.
You know, I fell in love with reading at a young age, and I loved the way certain authors were able to just capture my imagination, move me deeply emotionally, and I wanted to be able to do that with people. And so I started writing. I then went on to college, and I studied creative writing in college. And so always wanted to be a writer.
And when did you first recognize that you had the talent for writing?
I think pretty quickly. I wrote a lot in high school. I wrote for our school newspaper, and we had a literature magazine, and so I wrote short stories and poetry. And I was just really blessed to have some great teachers who, you know, whether I had a gift back then or not, I don't know, but I'll assume that they didn't lie to me, but they told me, Bruce, that you do have a gift for this, and they encouraged me, and they taught me and coached me, corrected me along the way. They gave me honest criticism and feedback, but never in a way that wounded or damaged my spirit.
Mm-hmm.
So I was just really blessed with some really great teachers in my life, both in high school and in college.
I did some research on you, and I felt that you were a software engineer, and you actually had your first job at IBM. Is that correct?
I did. You know, I mean, that makes perfectly good sense, right? A guy who all he ever wants to be in life is a writer, and so he writes in high school. He studies exclusively English creative writing. I have still to this day never in my life taken a computer class, wow. Although I have taught many, many, many of them. I've taught computers and software development all over the world. And yeah, so when I graduated from college, you know, the logical step for a writer is to take a job in computer sales with IBM, right?
Yeah. Well, here's the deal. You have to write code, right?
You know, and that really is it. It does tend to make a little bit more sense than that. You know, I was, you know, given my age, if you can do the math, yep. I was in college in the early 80s. Okay. And that's when the IBM personal computer came out and hit the scene. Mm-hmm. And I had no interest in being a computer science major. And there's a reason why on most college campuses, they keep the computer science majors on one end of the campus and the English and humanities majors on the other side of the campus.
Absolutely.
Because we tend to not have a lot in common. Mm-hmm. Yet I became fascinated by the personal computer simply because, I don't know, how old are you, Fred?
I am 44 years old, sir, so I know exactly what you were talking about.
Yeah, so you, I've got a little bit of years on you, but, you know, In my days, we didn't go off to college with a shiny new laptop or with an iPad or any of that stuff.
Absolutely.
We didn't have computers even available to us until, you know, there were, you know, they set up personal computer labs in some of the buildings and made them available to the students. But really, unless you were enrolled in a class that taught you how to use it, you were on your own. Mm-hmm. I became fascinated by word processing, mm-hmm. because typing papers and stuff on a typewriter using whiteout, and you know, there was no moving of sentences around. There were no spell checkers.
Exactly.
There was no cut and paste. It was you ball the piece of paper up, you throw it in the trash can, and you start typing all over again. So I became fascinated by the word processor, mm-hmm. simply because it was a tool to help me be a better writer. I just had a natural aptitude. I mean, within days, the computer just made sense to me. Mm-hmm. I was able to figure it out more or less on my own. Mm-hmm. In fact, within about two months of my doing this, the professor who taught they did create a course called Academic Computing, okay. which was really, you know, introduction to word processing and spreadsheets. And, you know, not to sound gender biased, but basically it was a class for all the girls who were going on to be secretaries.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, because they were gonna have to learn how to use word processors as they worked in offices.
That's right.
And so the professor who was teaching that class noticed that I was already hanging out in the computer lab teaching all of my English major buddies how to use this stuff. He hired me to be his student aide.
Nice.
And so I wound up tutoring his students. And I'd never even taken his class before, but I wound up tutoring. I became his student aide. And, you know, because I had very, very strong communication skills, he actually was the one who had some connections at IBM and made the referral. And so I had a job offer for IBM before I even graduated from college.
When you transitioned over and started working in that area, were you happy with that career?
I was miserable in that career. I just didn't know it.
Mm.
I actually did right out of right out of the bat. I was only with IBM for about 4 years,
okay.
and the problem is that I was very successful
okay.
at it, and I made more money than a 23-year-old should realistically be making. I had no idea what to do with it. I had an ego that certainly matched the size of the money that I was making.
Right.
I had a friend talk me into starting my own company. And, you know, so I took an awful lot of bad advice that was all ego-driven. I ignored a lot of very wise advice that people had given me mm-hmm. because I was like, nope, I'm good. I've got this. I don't need any, you know, just tell me, you know, the fastest way I can make as much money as I possibly can. And by the time I was 27 years old, I was sitting in federal bankruptcy court, having lost my nice house and my car and most of my self-esteem. Oh. You know, so I was miserable because what happened was that I bought in to this. I came through life, you know, and maybe one of the reasons that I wanted to be a writer, you know, people who you know, I guess have a lot of self-work that they need to do on themselves, they either become writers or psychology majors, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
you know, so because we want to work on ourselves. Yeah. And so I actually really did have a very poor self-esteem and self-image. And, you know, I did not have a foundation of self-worth. And what I did was I bought right into the all-American dream that at least for men, which seems to be the trapping, yes. is that our identity, our self-worth, our self-esteem, all comes from our career, our success in our career, our ability to attract women into our lives, everything outside of ourselves. And so when things are going really, really well, we feel really good about ourselves. And when things aren't going so well, we don't feel so good about ourselves. And so for me, it was all about, you know, the pursuit of happiness from external things, right. from money, from material possession, from having friends, from having the approval of my wife or, you know, or friends or all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And so the problem is that I was miserable. I tricked myself into thinking that I could find happiness. And if I wasn't happy, then I must not be working hard enough, or I must not have achieved enough of whatever it is I needed. So I always kept setting higher goals. And really, by the time I was 40 years old, I was really close to being suicidal. Wow. I absolutely hated everything about my life. Mm. I had filed bankruptcy, you know, when I was 27. I then filed bankruptcy again when I was 41. Because we had our first child, who my son is now 18 years old. Wow. I have another son who is now 12 years old. So there's 6 years in between them. Right. In between our two kids, we had a daughter. And my daughter passed away tragically.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
And the 8 days in severe intensive care on a total heart-lung bypass machine cost me $1.2 million to try to keep her alive.
Wow.
And while insurance covered the vast majority of that, I had several hundred thousands of dollars of medical debt that was not covered by insurance. And for a couple of years, I really, really tried to dig out from under that. But I was already so depleted as a human being that I just had nothing left. So it was like trying to drive my car with zero oil in the engine. Yeah. You know, I kept trying to put gasoline in it, mm. you know, thinking that that's what it needed, but it needed oil. And after a while, the engine just seizes up.
Wow.
And that's where I was. Yeah. I was totally depleted by the time I was 42 years old, partly because, well, not partly, entirely because I had, you know, if you had asked me who I am, mm. if you had said, Bruce, who are you? At that point, I would have only been able to answer that question by telling you what I do.
Mm-hmm.
I could have only answered the question by the roles that I play. You know, so by that time, I was a business owner again. And so I would have told you, well, I'm a business owner, and I'm a husband, and I'm a dad, and I'm a this, and I'm a that. But all the time, you know, there were struggles in my business. There were struggles in my marriage. There were struggles in my parenting. I'd filed bankruptcy twice.
Right.
So in my mind, I'm a two-time loser,
right?
Right. And so, you know, there are difficulties in my marriage. So I must not be a great husband. Mm-hmm. You know, my parenting isn't bringing me the type of joy that I see other parents getting from them. So I must not be a good parent. Mm-hmm. And so by the time I was just done, I had nothing left. So that's really where I was. And that was me hitting rock bottom and then having to make a real tough decision at 42 years old, because, you know, the longevity of Van Horn men puts us in our mid 80s. If I have got to live another 40 years like this, I just don't want to be a part of that. And so something had to change.
Well, let me ask you this. What was your turnaround moment? Because it sounds like through all of that, like you said, that would have took somebody else out. What kept you together and how did you turn it around?
Well, I was ready to be taken out, and I was willing to be taken out at that point. You know, I probably at that point was too much of a coward to be brave enough to take my own life. Mm-hmm. So I sort of wished an accident upon myself so right. that I didn't have to do it myself.
Right.
But my life changed through a very unexpected twist of fate, which, you know, I believe that it's divine providence.
Mm-hmm.
But my older brother came to Richmond, Virginia in November of 2005. I had just turned 42 years old, and he ran the Richmond Marathon.
Mm-hmm.
And later on that evening, he spent the evening with us, and he said, "Bruce, you should do this." And I said, "I should do what?" And he said, "You should run marathons." And I laughed at the man because, you know, I was way out of shape.
Right.
I hadn't exercised a lick since I graduated from high school.
Right.
And so, I mean, realistically, I mean, one of the points that I was probably hurting in was my inability to even play with my kids.
Mm-hmm.
Because after 15 minutes of riding bikes or playing in the yard, I'm having to sit down and say, "Wait a minute, let daddy catch his breath."
Right. Okay.
And so, I said, "No way. I don't want, you know, I don't even like driving 26 miles unless
right,
I'm going
exactly.
on vacation.
Let alone running a marathon."
Yeah. And then my brother's not a motivational speaker or a life coach, and he had no idea. But God puts the right person in our lives with the right word at
yes,
the right time to turn us around. And what he said at that moment didn't change my life, but I never forgot his words. He said, "Bruce, the hardest part about running a marathon is making the decision to do it."
Mm.
And I didn't believe him because I was pretty sure the hardest part about running a marathon was the actual running
right,
part.
Yeah.
But I didn't believe him. But I did let him, I did let that be enough motivation for me to join the gym and hit the treadmill, try to shed a few extra pounds, but mostly to try to get in better shape just so that I could hang out with my kids and do stuff. But that was a miserable process. But I got up and I did it every morning. I hit the gym. I ran on the treadmill. I jogged. It was, you know, nowhere even close to running.
Right, exactly.
And I did not think that I would ever get to the point where I could jog 1 mile on a treadmill
mm-hmm.
without walking.
Mm-hmm.
But once I did, something in me snapped. And it was only like a week or so later that I was able to run 2 miles without walking.
Nice.
And then I was able to run farther, and I was starting to enjoy running. It was an escape for me because I was able to get up early in the morning and just go do something just for me,
yes.
which I had never done in my entire married life. I had never done any kind of self-care. And so this was just for me. I was enjoying it. And so later on, you know, it's now becoming the spring of 2006. I ran a local 5K, and that was fun. And then someone asked me to run a 10K with them, and so I did that. And at that point, I decided, you know what? I'm going to take my brother's challenge. I'm going to run a freaking marathon.
There you go.
And so I started training, and so through the summer of 2006, I started marathon training and developed my endurance. I was feeling very good, very confident about what was happening with my physical body. I was still an emotional wreck. I still absolutely hated my life. I was a miserable, sulky, sarcastic, cynical person. It was no fun to be around. Mm-hmm. But I was enjoying at least this aspect of my life. And I was out one morning, early one morning in the summer of 2006, and I was doing an 18-mile run. And during my long runs, God and I, we were doing some serious talking. You know, we often pray as if we are God and God is supposed to be working for us. So I had this long list of things God wasn't doing right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm doing all of these things. I have tried to be a good man. I've tried to be a good husband, a good, you know, provider for my family, and none of this is working out. Are you not paying attention down here? Mm. You know, what is the deal? So I came to a screeching halt in the middle of the road. The sun was rising up over the horizon, and I had tears in my eyes because I had a revelation. Mm. And it was the revelation that, first of all, my brother was right.
Yes.
The hardest part about running a marathon is making the decision to do it. But I had misunderstood my brother. Mm. I thought it was a decision that you made once.
Right.
But Fred, it's a decision that I had to make absolutely every day. And I was making it every single day to get up and go run and to transform my physical health. And I was doing that. But basically what God revealed to me, If earlier that morning you had met me as I was lacing up my shoes and you said, Bruce, what's your problem? Mm-hmm. I would have had zero hesitation to tell you what all of my problems were,
right,
and who exactly was to blame for all of my problems. Right. Guess who was not on that list?
Who?
I was not on that list. Mm-hmm. Everybody else was to blame. And basically what God said to me at that moment was, Bruce, you have a Bruce problem. Mm. You have a thinking problem. Everything that's wrong with your life from your perspective is 100% your fault because you are choosing to think the way you think. If you will just open your eyes and see how blessed you are, the abundance that you do have, it might not be according to the plan you had set out for your life, but it's according to my plan for you.
Yes, yes.
And I'm choosing the paths that you need to walk down, but you get to choose your attitude. And if you will change your attitude, you will see that this path is a lot more enjoyable than you think it is. And so I owned that. I was like, oh my God,
yeah,
you're right. So if I can take control of my decisions, if I can change, you have to control your thought in order to be a marathon runner. And so it occurred to me that I could probably, if I could change my body, I could change my entire life simply by making the decision to think differently.
Yes.
And that's where it all started. And so this is where the transformation really started to happen. And I really did catch myself, coached myself when I started being cynical or sarcastic. I said, Bruce, is that who you want to be? And I'd say, no, that's not who I want to be. So, okay, well, let's try a different thought. Let's try different self-talk. Let's try a different perspective on whatever it is that you're pissed off or upset about. Mm-hmm. Let's start rethinking this situation. And so I started doing that. My life radically changed. And I won't say that it happened overnight. It certainly, transforming my attitude did not happen nearly as fast as transforming
right.
my body.
Right.
I will say, though, that later that year, November of 2006, 1 year later, my brother came back to Richmond, and we ran the Richmond Marathon together, and I beat him.
You beat him. Nice.
I beat the boy, yeah, quite handsomely, too.
Oh, nice.
And so marathon running became a way of life for me, but what it what it did, you know, that's, it's why my podcast is called Life is a Marathon, which has absolute, I've almost never talk about running.
Wow.
But in order to run a marathon, you have to have the very same mindsets, the attitudes, the expectations or lack thereof. In order to be successful at a marathon, it's the same disciplines that will make you successful in life. And it's all about decisions. It's all about thoughts. It's all about having a longer range vision for your life. Life isn't a sprint. So that's really sort of where the transition was. And it was actually several years later that a guy I knew, we weren't even friends, but his son and my son were the same age. They played on the same soccer teams and basketball teams or were opposing teams within the same community league. But we, you know, so we were soccer field dads and, you know, we were, hey, how's it going kind of dads with, you know, no depth. And one afternoon on a soccer field, he came up to me and he said, Bruce, I don't know anything about you, but there is obviously something that has changed about your life. Just the way you carry yourself, the way you interact with your son and the other kids is so different than it has been over the last years. What in the world is going on? And so I started telling him about my story. And he said, I don't know what you've got, but I want it in my life, and I want you to be my life coach. I had never even heard the phrase life coach before. So I said, what in the world is that? So he told me, I said, well, that sort of sounds like a cross between a psychotherapist and a best friend. He said, yeah, basically. And so he insisted on paying me, you know, it was like $20, but we'd meet for coffee at Starbucks and we'd talk, and I would basically just start coaching him on the things that I did in my life. And I didn't know if they would work in his life, but I said, well, this is what I did. He'd tell me about the whatever it was he was dealing with in his life, and where there were parallels, I could say, well, I had something similar to my life, and this is how I deal with that now. And so it worked for him. He referred me to two of his buddies, and it just sort of grew from there. And I really did start to feel a lot better about who I was. I was getting back into writing, which I had given up for 20 years. And so now my life was coming back to full circle as to where I really felt called as a teenager. But then, yeah, life doesn't happen in a straight path, does it?
It really doesn't. There's certain times where you get to a certain point, and then all of a sudden, it drops out. Did it drop out on you?
Oh, yeah, it dropped out big time in me.
We at Studio22Live.tv appreciate all of our listeners all over the world. We want to remind you to give us a call at 610-466-5461. Like us on Instagram. Like us on our Twitter page. Like us also on our Facebook page. And help us continue to grow this show. If you got any questions, comments, or suggestions, hit us up at studio22livetv@gmail.com. Always positive and always on. Now back to the show.
So there are some significant dates here. Valentine's Day, February 14th, 2013, was my son's 16th birthday. And, you know, 16, big sweet 16 is supposed to be a big birthday celebration. And, you know, so it was, we had gathered family and friends in our favorite Italian restaurant to celebrate my son's 16th birthday. And just to do a little bit of backstory that, I've mentioned several times that my marriage was always very difficult. Mm-hmm. My wife had very significant mental health and physical health issues throughout her entire life. Okay. And we didn't really know what it was specifically. We finally got a diagnosis 5 or 6 years prior to this event.
Right.
And it was manageable, but my wife suffered from severe schizophrenia. And so she was constantly hearing voices.
My mother suffered from the same thing. I know exactly what you're
talking
about.
Tough. Yeah. it's tough. And, you know, they would cause her to do really weird things or go through weird personality shifts and stuff. But in the middle of my son's 16th birthday party, the voices that she was hearing told her to kill my boys.
Oh.
And, yeah, so that, and she announced this in the middle of the birthday party.
Oh.
And so,
Jesus.
Had to be taken away, obviously, and institutionalized. She's out, and we see her, but she can never have unsupervised visits with the boys ever again.
Right.
I have full custody. We're divorced, and I have full custody of the boys.
Okay.
Yeah, but that was traumatic,
sure.
Obviously. And I had done another really, really significant thing. What I thought was me being a really good dad is I had protected my boys from my wife all their lives.
Right.
And so I taught them how to walk on eggshells. I taught them how to lie to her. You know, they get in trouble at school and they would come and tell me. They were always very close to me. And I'd say, okay, well, we'll figure out a way to deal with that, but we've got to craft a story to tell your mom so she doesn't come unhinged.
Okay.
And, you know, so, shortly after that event, I think 3 days later, my oldest son was so traumatized by it that he became suicidal.
Oh.
And so I had to put him in the hospital while my wife is in the hospital and dealing with my youngest son. But eventually, we really started to build our lives again. And so the three of us boys learned how to manage just the three of us in our household together. And we had to undo some very, very unhealthy communication skills that we had developed over the years. And we had to develop a total honesty policy, which took us a while. It took me a while, you know, because there were just things I always hid from them. And, you know, it was just so unhealthy. And so we finally, you know, 1 year later are hitting our stride and we're getting back in the swing of things again. And so exactly 1 year and 3 days later, I had just put my youngest son on the school bus.
Okay.
I had just turned 50 years old. And for my physical checkup at age 50, there was some blood work that came back not so great, which caused me to need to have a biopsy done. But even during the biopsy process, my doctor saying, you know what, Bruce, we did this as a precaution, but everything that I'm seeing looks really good. Let's not worry about this. Enjoy your weekend. I'll call you Monday and Tuesday when the results come back from the lab.
Right.
And so he didn't call on Monday, but he did call on Tuesday, February 17th at 9:22 in the morning. I just put my son on the school bus. I was eating breakfast. I looked at the caller ID and I knew who it was,
right. But
I also had a vision. I had instant clarity that even before I answered the phone, I knew exactly what he was going to tell me. And I knew that eating breakfast that morning would be the last normal thing that I would do for a very, very long time. And I answered the phone and he said, Bruce, I have no idea how to tell you this, but you've got stage 4 prostate cancer.
Oh my God.
Whoa. Yeah. At 50 years old. Now, again, there's providence in this you know, I don't know, you told me how old you are, but I don't know if you've ever had your prostate, your PSA tested.
Yeah, I had it tested when I was 40, actually. I'm 44, so yeah.
Good for you, my friend.
Thank
good
you.
For you,
Thank
because
you.
When I was 44, I do have a family history of prostate cancer. So I told my doc, I said, you know, he was drawing blood for my cholesterol, and he said, you know, I said, yeah, I want you to go ahead and start testing my PSA. And he said, no, you know, and for everybody who's listening, people aren't aware of that. The PSA is a prostate-specific antigen, and it is the blood test for prostate cancer. Every male who is alive and has a prostate has a PSA number. And it doesn't really matter what that number is. Ideally, the lower, the better. When I said at 44, you're going to start testing my PSA, he said, no, we don't do that until you turn 50. Mm. And I said, no, I want you to start doing it now because I have a family history. And he said, well, how old were the guys in your family when they got it? And I said, they were in their 60s and, you know, or early 70s. And he said, well, that's about the normal time for prostate cancer. So, no, we don't test your we're not going to test you until you're 50. And I said, no, you're going to test me now. And so he did start testing me. And so I got my baseline number because, as you know, what they want is an initial number. Fortunately or unfortunately, depending on the way you want to look at it, prostate cancer is among the slowest growing of all forms of cancer. So what they're looking for is on your annual physicals, how much does that number change? And so when you get your first one, that's a baseline. And unless the number is really high, I've got friends who have a PSA of 13 who don't have cancer.
Okay.
My initial baseline was 1.8. Okay. And it had been growing. They don't want more than like a tenth of a point growth per year. And so, you know, through the years, it had been growing. But when I went in for my 50th checkup, my number was 2.75, which if that had been my very first baseline number, that would have thrown no alarms whatsoever. But my PSA when I was 49 was 2.2.
Okay.
And so a jump from 2.2 to 2.75 is what caused my doctor to be alarmed and wanted to do a prostate biopsy. Had I waited until I was 50 and got that 2.75 and they said, okay, well, we've got a baseline, we'll see you when you're 51, I'd be dead today.
Wow.
Because I was already stage four. That kicked me on my butt.
Yeah, that would. I mean, anybody. And I just want to just thank you for just being able to share that education because, you know, no matter what, who you are, where you are, that is so important. I can't stand that word cancer. And we are dealing with that every single day. But just being able to share what you need to do. A lot of people, a lot of men, especially men in our African-American community as well, we don't go because of the fact that we don't want to find out, but the key that you just said was prevention. It's being able to get it done early enough. So I want to encourage all our listeners, just what Mr. Van Horst said, you want to go get it checked because who wants to find out at stage four? At least get the test.
It's a blood test.
Mm-hmm.
Prostate cancer is among the most treatable of all forms of cancer also, if it's caught early.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just because you get a diagnosis of prostate cancer doesn't mean you're going to have surgery. It doesn't mean, you know, the problem is that prostate cancer, you know, we can get a little indelicate here, but what's wrapped around your prostate are all the nerves that control male erectile function.
Right.
And so, you know, what tradition was that as soon as a man got prostate cancer, he lost his erectile function.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know what the thinking is that if we just ignore the problem, mm-hmm. that we'll never have that problem. But it doesn't work out that way. So, again, I had already done the kind of mental work. I was already in a much better place. Had I gotten this type of diagnosis or even what had gone on with my wife the year before, mm-hmm. had that happened when I was in my 40s, I would not be here, Fred.
Right.
I would have just said, you know what, this is it, I'm done.
Right. How did your boys respond to it?
They had a typical response. Given all the things that we've been through together, they're like, all right, well, what now? What else is going to go wrong in our lives? But I was able to coach them through it because everything is thought. Everything is a story that we tell ourselves. And if we tell ourselves that we're a victim, if we tell ourselves that life is always going to suck, then guess what it will be? We our thoughts become things. You know, we manifest into our lives that which we think about the most because our thoughts control our behaviors. And so I was already at a much healthier place. I won't say that I wasn't upset. I cried like a baby for 2 hours sitting at my kitchen table while my cereal got soggy. It was actually it was a day or two later before I told my boys, because I had to get myself right. I had to, you know, I wanted to show them a brave face. I wanted to say, okay, here's what it is. Here's how I am responding to this. I'm not going to react to this. I'm going to respond. And we're going to go through this. We're going to go through this together. Because the cancer was so advanced, my urologist, who he does these surgeries all the time, he said, Bruce, given how young you are, I don't want to do your surgery. I'm going to refer you to a guy who's the best. And he's tough to see, but we'll try to get you in. And well, Dr. Morgan wasn't available until like September or October of 2014. But my doctor said, you know what? I play golf with the guy. I'll call him on his cell phone and we'll see what we can do. And so he was able to get me an appointment and I was able to have surgery on April 7th. So just 2 months after my diagnosis. Prostate cancer surgery is you've got a couple options. You can do the Da Vinci Code robot method, which is very non-invasive, okay, or you can go for the full radical retropubic prostatectomy, which is a 9-inch incision from your belly button to your pubic bone, and it's pulling the muscles apart. It's basically having a C-section for a guy, right? You know, so that's what you've got to do. You've got to cut the belly open. You've got to move all of the muscles. And then you've got to go in and do the surgery. My surgeon said, Bruce, given we have two goals, we want to get all of the cancer. We know it has breached the prostate wall, but we don't yet know if it has metastasized to your lymph systems. So we're going to have to do some exploratory probing around in there. But still, they said, you know, the surgery will be an hour and a half long. You'll spend one night, possibly two nights in the hospital. Mm-hmm. And you're going to be pretty sore. You know, you're going to have a huge incision. So we went through all of that process. Well, when I woke up out of surgery, I could immediately tell from the looks of the nurses, from all of the equipment that was around me that I didn't really anticipate being around me. The look on my mother's face told me that something had gone horribly wrong.
Okay.
Yeah, so 5-hour surgery, and wound up being a week in the hospital, and I was discharged from the hospital not because I was in any shape to go home, but because the insurance company said we're not paying for it anymore.
Wow.
I lost 70% of my blood on the operating table. The anesthesiologist said, Doc, you've got to just close this boy up. We are losing him. My blood pressure fell dangerously low. My heart was not able to sustain it anymore. But I absolutely love my surgeon who saved my life, because he told me, he said, Bruce, we've got two goals. We're going to go in. We're going to get rid of the prostate. We're going to find out if there's any other cancer. We're going to get all of that. And our secondary goal is we are going to protect those nerves for you because you're a young man. Okay, we're going to protect those nerves.
Yes.
Well, when he opened me up, my floor nurses had lunch with my surgical nurses later that day, and so they told me what had happened.
Right.
And when Dr. Morgan cut me open, which is normally a bloodless surgery, babies, you know, women deliver babies via C-section. The only blood is the actual cutting of the skin.
Right.
You know, the rest of it's just moving stuff around.
Mm-hmm.
But when he cut me open and opened up my belly, he said, oh, and insert expletive. So what I had was a massive bundle of blood vessels also wrapped around my prostate, which men don't normally have.
Oh.
And not only is that an anatomical anomaly, it was also somewhat indicative of the extent of the cancer, because your body will grow things in an attempt to protect itself. But surgeons hate to operate in blood because you can't see what you're doing.
Right.
And so had this been an appendectomy, had this been colon surgery or whatever, a surgeon would have just cauterized those blood vessels to seal them off.
Right.
But you can't cauterize a blood vessel that's wrapped around a nerve that we're trying to protect.
Right.
Now, had it been another surgeon, had my doctor said, you know what, I'm backed up all day with surgeries. We're going to get the cancer, but we're going to just have to tell Bruce, sorry, on goal number two. My surgeon didn't do that. He stayed on task. He stayed on mission. He wound up cutting every single one of the blood vessels individually and let me bleed while he did the work.
Okay.
And then he timed it perfectly so that he did his work fast enough while bleeding, and he was then able to go back and hand suture each one of those little tiny blood vessels. And you know, so I am cancer free.
Oh, cool.
I have my functioning.
Yes.
So I'm 18 months out now, and I have a PSA of zero.
Woo.
Which is good.
Praise God.
That's the perfect news. But yes, the recovery from the surgery was brutal, and it was actually through that process that I got more gifts from God. And it wound up being the subject of the book that I wrote this year called Worry No More, which is an international bestseller.
Congratulations.
And so I write about my – thank you. Yeah, see, because one of the really cool things about going to hospitals to have major surgery is they've got these amazing drugs that they can give you so you don't feel anything.
Right.
Right. You know, so when you lose 70% of your blood, though, guess what they can't give you?
Oh, no. My gosh. They can't give you the drugs.
So I had to do radical retropubic prostatectomy on no pain medication. Yeah, literally gut-wrenching pain. And so what I had to do for the first 3 days in the hospital, the pain was so severe that the only way I could manage it was literally by focusing on my breathing. I would just take one breath at a time, and I'd breathe in, I'd breathe out, and I'd say, okay, you took a breath, you didn't die, let's do another one. Mm. And I wouldn't count them, I wouldn't string them together. I treated them as unique events. And then somewhere along the line, I had this epiphany that it's not a unique event. It's actually every single breath that you take, Fred, is a unique miracle.
Yes, it is.
The fact that a human can breathe, no scientist can explain what makes a human being stay alive. I mean, we can understand the whole process while it's processing, right?
Right.
But have you ever met a biologist or chemist or any scientist? No scientist can explain life. We can't reproduce it. We can take a living thing and another living thing and create another living thing, but we've never been able to create life.
Yes.
So each breath is a miracle. Each breath is a gift. And so while I thought I was doing pretty good at being thankful for everything, it was really like God said to me, Bruce, you have no idea, and I'm about to show you just how blessed you are. Mm-hmm. And just how much I love you.
Wow.
And sometimes God has to show us how much he loves us by taking everything away from us.
Yes.
Everything that we have substituted for God. And, you know, so that's really where I came out of that, is this awareness that if I can breathe, I have everything I need. I don't need anything else in any given moment, because realistically, the only moment that I have is this second right now that I'm talking to you. I'm not guaranteed 5 minutes from now. And 5 minutes, when we started this call, that doesn't exist anymore except in our memories.
Right.
All that exists is right now. And if I can breathe, everything else is bonus.
Man, you could not put that better. I am just so humbled that for your incredible, incredible story. I thank you so much. You just got me at a loss for words, and that's not common for me. But I tell you, I really, really appreciate this is, to me, I think this is just going, it's just so life-changing. I think that when people, you know, they chase the wrong things in life because of our, you know, how we come up, and we chase it for money and fame and the American dream. But just what you just said, if you can breathe, that is all that you need. It may not be what you want, like you said, but it's all that you need. Mr. Van Horn, thank you so much for being able to come on the show and share this, your incredible journey, your story, and the blessing. You have blessed my heart, and I'm a Christian as well, and I didn't get a chance to mention that to you, but I didn't have to. God knew exactly how to connect us. He knew exactly what he was doing, and you've actually changed me. I felt myself changing as you was talking. I just want to thank you.
You're very welcome. There is no separation between you and I, because God is the energy that keeps us alive and everything alive. And so it's just that radical appreciation. We are never, you know, the other thing that I discovered was that, you know, I think that, you know, that we have this idea of God as being something that's outside of us, or something, or someone who's always watching over us. Mm-hmm. God is omnipresent, which means God is in every single atom that exists in this universe, because there's nowhere you can go that God isn't, and there's nothing that exists that God didn't create, and everything exists for a purpose. And I learned that, you know, if he chose to save me and keep me alive through this, there's got to be a reason.
Yes.
There's got to be a reason, you know. So that's what I try to do every day. Is just, you know, happiness is a choice.
That's it.
It's a choice. It's not based on conditions. And that's what I always tried to make it all my life. I would just be happy if. Well, the only if for conditional upon your happiness is if you choose to be happy.
Your book, Worry No More, and you can go to Amazon's bestseller. They're online. They can get it at Amazon.com. We're going to update our show notes as well to be able to get Bruce's information for his website. He is an international bestseller. He is a blessing to me. Thank you for coming on the show, and I want you to have an incredibly, incredibly phenomenal year. Thank you so, so much. I'm just extremely humbled, and hopefully we can get you back on the show one day.
I'd love it. Right. Thanks, Fred. All right. You have an amazing day.
Thank you, sir. I'll be in touch, and congratulations to your son getting ready to graduate. Congratulations for you.
Yes,
just
sir.
Being who you are, because I got five of them myself, so I definitely know the reason.
Goodness.
Thank you, sir. You have a great day. At the end of every episode, when you listen to the Steel22Live.tv podcast, you are always going to be able to look forward to some words of encouragement, inspiration, or words of wisdom that can get you through the rest of your day, the rest of your week, or the rest of the year. And the one I want to end with today, since we're on the topic of health, is simply this. And it's for all of our listeners who are always on a diet, off a diet, on a diet. Remove the word diet from your vocabulary. Stop dieting. Here's a great quote for you. Don't start a diet that has an expiration date and will only last a short day. Instead, focus on a lifestyle that will last forever. Studio 22. Thank you so much for listening to Studio22Live.tv podcast. We hope that you've enjoyed today's episode. We strive to continue to add value to the lives of all of our listeners, and we appreciate you for giving us time out of your day. Don't forget, you can contact us at 610-466-5461, and you can also email us if you'd like to be a guest on the show at studeo22live.tv@gmail.com.